Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my website at dr-history.com for a short personal video message, to listen to the latest stories, and to leave a comment.
Right now, without further ado, and without all the pomp and circumstance, here he is, Dr. History.
Good morning, Zeb.
Hi,
good
buddy.
Morning.
How are you?
Great, great. Had a good weekend with my family and still eating leftovers.
What, 75 or 80 people were there?
Oh, probably 800 or 900.
I see. And
how about 25?
Like Jesus on the Mount, you just reached into the basket
everybody.
And fed them fish.
We did.
Okay.
So I got to say hi to a few people.
All right.
I want to say hi to Ian back in New Jersey. He had some more information about Bass Reeves. David has suggested I do a story about the Trail of Tears. Travis also had some more information about Bass Reeves. Let's see. Bill gave me some information about the Uchi Indians in eastern Tennessee that we talked about. And then Jeff, who's been a listener for quite a long time, he sent me some more pictures about on Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Oh, good.
So we've had some really good response here in the last
week. Isn't it funny? And back off maybe a little bit on the mic. It's okay. A little fuzzy. But Bass Reeves, for some reason, boy, that really piqued a lot of interest.
It did. It really did. Yeah. So,
yeah. You did a good job. On that story.
Yeah, he was a fun one to talk about.
He was did you say he was a pretty big man in stature?
I think he was, but you know, the comparison is with him and the Lone Ranger.
Oh, that's what it was.
That's the comparison, yeah.
That's what it was.
So today, Zeb, we're going to talk about something I have never really talked about before that probably a lot of people don't think relates to the Old West.
Your financial situation.
No, we don't want to go there. How about boxing, Zeb? Boxing.
Now, I will say that I've read some stories of the Old West where pugilism was really the main attraction of a sport for those folks.
Oh, yeah. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Okay.
So,
right.
You know, the manly art of prize fighting has been around since the beginning of recorded time. But only in the last decade has the sport been promoted into a billion-dollar industry.
Mm.
The evolution of boxing from a working-class pastime of bare-knuckle brawling to a pay-per-view mega attraction can be traced back to two legendary lawmen from the Old West. Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson.
You're kidding.
No.
I didn't know.
And that was a surprise to me. But so Wyatt arrived in Nome, Alaska in the summer of 1899.
That was after he was in Tombstone and everything, wasn't it?
By then, Wyatt had gained some fame in the boxing world, and it wasn't all necessarily good.
Mm.
So Wyatt, in his early 20s, actually began officiating boxing matches across Wyoming territory for railroad crews and buffalo hunters. And before Wyatt got linked with heavyweight champion Bob Fitzsimmons, a pal of Wyatt's, good friend of his, Bat Masterson, helped Judge Roy Bean promote a fight between Fitzsimmons and a guy by the name of Peter Mayer. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, with boxing outlawed in Texas, the bout was fought in a makeshift ring on Mexican soil in the town of, I hope I say this right, Coahuila? Coahuila?
How's it spelled?
Coahuila. Coahuila? I think. Anyway,
I have to look at.
But it has spectators viewing the fight from a hillside overlooking the Rio Grande, and a former lawman in Dodge City, Kansas, Masterson secured the ticket handling and the fighting purse. He also covered the sport in his Denver, Colorado newspaper column for it was called George's Weekly, and promoted prize fights at his Olympic Athletic Club.
Really?
Now, Masterson's history in the boxing arena included serving as the timekeeper at the very first World Heavyweight Championship under the Queensberry rules. And you've heard of that. I really don't know exactly what those are.
And this was all bare knuckle.
Yeah.
Woo.
So in this 1892 battle, and you've heard of this, Gentleman Jim Corbett defeated Boston Strong Boy John L. Sullivan by a knockout in 21 rounds.
Let me ask you quickly, if you were in a fist fight, in a pugilistic fight with Wyatt Earp as the referee or whatever, and you got the living you-know-what out of you, why would you want to go back and do it again?
I wouldn't last past the first hit. So anyway, and then by in 1896, there was a bout in Mexico, and heavyweight champion Fitzsimmons scored a knockout win in 95 seconds. And anyway, Masterson moved on along the boxing circuit, and later that year, they had kind of a scandal that erupted.
Uh-oh.
So here we are. We're in San Francisco. So California heavyweight contest, Fitzsimmons landed a three-punch combination on, quote, Sailor Tom Sharkey, with the last punch hitting below the belt.
Oh, boy.
Now, Wyatt ruled the final blow a foul and awarded the fight and his $10,000 purse to Sharkey.
And the network cut to a commercial.
Yeah, and Sharkey got $10,000. Which would be like at least 100 or 100,000 or more today.
Wow.
Now, a friend of Sharkey's manager, Danny Lynch, Wyatt was accused of fixing the fight, which he, of course, he denied. But Fitzsimmons, he left. He was mad. He was, you know, angry, and the crowd was kind of not very happy with this whole thing anyway. And that all kind of blew over. But anyway, so hoping to find some of the gold glittering on the shores of Nome, Alaska, Wyatt arrived there with his wife, Josie. He'd been invited by a friend, a guy named George Lewis Tex Rickard. Now, I'm going to talk a lot about this guy, Tex Rickard.
Okay.
So keep that guy in mind. He's going to...
Tex. Gotcha.
Tex Rickard.
Okay.
So, actually, Tex was born in Kansas City, Missouri in 1870.
Yep, I can see why they called him Tex.
Yeah, because he was born in Missouri,
yeah.
Right? So, in 1870, he actually was reared in North Texas.
I see.
So, that's where it comes in,
okay.
Zip.
All right.
And he actually worked as a city marshal in Henrietta. Rickard had rushed to Alaska during the gold strike of 1895. He staked claims for 2 years until the Klondike discovery of 1897 pulled him into the greatest stampede in American history, that Klondike gold rush, you know,
yeah.
It thousands and thousands. So a move to Dawson marked the beginning of Tex Rickard's golden touch. Within a year, his claims had paid close to $60,000.
Wow.
So over $600,000, $800,000 in today's. Well, he used his prospecting success in purchasing a nice thriving saloon called the Northern. And his eagerness to multiply his fortunes kind of got the best of him. He gambled away pretty much all of it. His business in Dawson's, he just went under. And when Rickard struck pay dirt again, he poured his earnings into a newer saloon, the Northern, and at that time was actually the largest saloon in Nome, Alaska.
Really?
So it's one of those things where you make a bunch, you lose a bunch, you come back, you make a bunch more, and it's going to get even better for him.
Yeah.
So we're back to Wyatt and his wife, Josie. They had previously tried their luck in the Yukon in 1897. They made it as far as Juneau, Alaska, before turning back. And reportedly, it was because Josie was pregnant, although it said that she later miscarried.
She was a professional singer, wasn't she?
I think she was.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the next year, they made it to a place called Wrangell, where bad weather forced them to hold up until the spring thaw. By that time, they moved to a place called Rampart. The Klondike rush was pretty much all but over. So after arriving in Nome in 1899, Wyatt introduced Tex Rickard to the lucrative enterprise of live boxing shows.
Uh-oh.
This launched the career of one of America's greatest sports promoters. Okay, so... Like his pal Wyatt gambled on the saloon business. He built the Dexter Saloon with a guy named Hoxie, which opened in September.
Hoxie?
Hoxie.
Okay.
And Wyatt's fame as a gunslinger kind of drew business. You know, he was still a famous guy. But after 2 years, he sold his interest in the Dexter Saloon to Hoxie, transferred his mining claims to his wife's brother, Nathan. And Wyatt and Josie boarded the ship, the SS Roanoke, for Seattle, Washington. And actually, he had $80,000 at that time from all this venture, which, according to the story, was worth more than $2 million today.
Ooh, my.
But they moved to Tonopah, Nevada.
I didn't know that.
Where Wyatt ran a saloon and worked as a deputy U.S. Marshal. Now, you've been through Tonopah.
Oh, many times.
So have I. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now
I didn't see him.
I didn't either.
Oh, okay.
I drove right through.
Yeah.
So Tex Ricard followed the Earps a few years later, landing south in a place called Goldfield, when the Nevada's boomtown was in full swing, with the 1902 strike, the mining camp's population soared from a few scrub prospectors to 20,000 people. And at that time, it was Nevada's largest town.
Is it still there?
I don't know.
What's
I don't
the name
so.
Of it?
Goldfield.
I don't think it
yeah,
is.
I have not heard of it. So, well, anyway, so Tex Ricard opened the last and largest.
Whereabouts was it? Do you have any idea?
It just says south.
That kind of narrows it down a little bit.
So, I'm thinking south of Tonopah,
okay,
which is a long ways. But anyway, so Ricard opened the last and largest of his northern saloons. Now, Goldfield is also where Wyatt's brother Virgil lived out his last days. After arriving in 1904, Virgil was sworn in as deputy sheriff of Esmeralda County. Okay, with his left arm, you know, it'd been
He got shot up
and maimed, and was really useless because of the OK Corral shootout in Tombstone. Well, Virgil took a job as a security officer at the National Club Saloon, but he got pneumonia and he died in 1905.
Wow.
So now Tex Ricard found a distraction for Wyatt because they were together now. And Wyatt was, you know, he was sad over his older brother's death. But Ricard announced on the newswire that Goldfield wanted to host a world title fight.
Mm-hmm.
The first boxer to accept Ricard's challenge was the number one contender for the lightweight crown. His name was Oscar Battling Nelson.
I thought you were going to say promoted by Don King or something.
No.
Okay.
So Ricard needed to raise $30,000 so he could sign a guy named Joe Gans, and he was the country's first black lightweight champion. And with the help of a con artist and criminal stock trader George Rice, Ricard secured the funds within days. So a little shady stuff going on there.
Oh.
So Ricard stacked the purses, $10 and $20 gold pieces, in the window of the local bank, which, of course, was a huge amount at the time. But it put Goldfield in the headlines. So it was held on September 3rd, 1906. So the mixed race matchup became the longest bout of the centuries. Gans outfought the, quote, durable Dane, winning on a foul in the 42nd round.
Wait a minute. They didn't have a set number of rounds?
No, they just went till somebody won. The sold out 20,000 seat event paid $69,715, $1.92 million today. Rickard's next main event was Jack Johnson versus James L. Jeffries. Now, this is up in Reno. Billed again as the fight of the century, this July 4th, 1910 heavyweight contest paid out an unheard of sum of $120,000, which is $3.13 million today, to Johnson, so he would defend his title against the undefeated Jeffries. Now, Jeffries was lured out of his six-year retirement with a guaranteed payout of $60,000, which is $1.56 million today.
How much of those fights, or how many of those fights, were kind of rigged and somebody hit the canvas on purpose?
You know, if it were me, I'd just hit the canvas right off the bat.
He's down.
I'll take my $1.5 million and walk away.
There you go.
Anyways, and actually, in that particular fight, it only lasted 15 rounds. And
one only?
Jeffries got knocked out in the round 15. Well, anyway, when Johnson was defeated by Jess Willard in Havana, Cuba, on April 5th, 1915, Masterson reported on the fight from the New York Morning Telegraph. He was writing for them at the time. And here's what he said. Willard, quote, "Willard wore the crown until 1919, when he was crushed in three rounds by Manasseh Mahler, Jack Dempsey.
Oh.
The Ricard-promoted event launched the Roaring Twenties and the golden age of boxing in American boxing for the Blue Blood.
So now, was that still bare-knuckle or was it with gloves?
I don't know.
Because I don't think Dempsey ever fought bare-knuckle, did he?
I don't know. It's 1919, so I'm not sure. But anyway, when New York legalized boxing in 1920, Tex Ricard moved his promotional operations to Manhattan. By then, Ricard and Masterson were respected members of New York's high society. They were friends of the Astors, the Rockefellers, the Roosevelts. They would stroll the sidewalks of New York with their trademark fedora hat or Stetson hat.
Oh, my.
And gold-handled walking sticks.
Oh, my.
You know, they made quite a sight. Anyway, Ricard's first million-dollar gate took place on July 2nd, 1921, the bout between Dempsey and Georges Carpentier. More than 90,000 hysterical fans paid $1,789,000 to watch Dempsey demolish the Frenchman in four rounds. And actually, the fight was the first major radio broadcast of a sporting event.
Now, this, I believe that was with boxing gloves.
It could have been.
Yeah,
1921.
I think it was,
yeah. Anyway, Dempsey's was also Masterson's last heavyweight championship fight. He died on October 25th of a heart attack after writing a column for the New York Morning Telegraph. And about 500 people attended Masterson's funeral. Tex Ricard served as a pallbearer. But the sport of boxing kept punching on. Ricard assembled financial backers. He called what he called the, quote, 600 millionaires and constructed a third edition of New York's Madison Square Garden. And it was called the House That Tex Built.
You're kidding.
And it opened on 8th Avenue in December 1925.
Holy cow.
The modern setting made it fashionable for ladies and blue bloods to attend boxing matches. Well, Ricard also expanded his sports empire. He bought a National Hockey League team in 1926-27. They were the Rangers, later the New York Rangers. Okay, they won the Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
Then throughout the 1920s, Ricard kind of manipulated the press, continued to produce million-dollar gates. The Jack Dempsey Gene Tunney Championship rematch at Chicago Soldier Field generated a record $2.6 million, which would be $37 million today.
Today.
Yeah.
Tex Ricard.
Yeah. So anyway, things kept going on. I know we're about out of time here, but, you know, Rickard, actually, Wyatt got sick, and he died at age 80, and actually Ricard got sick and died about a week later.
Really? Wyatt died in California, didn't he?
I
thought he did.
Not sure. Yeah, I don't see that in my notes here. But
okay.
Anyway, there were thousands of mourners, and Ricard actually supposedly had a $15,000 bronze casket, which would have been probably $150,000 at least now. But
does he have any family members that are left in the in boxing sport?
I have no idea. I've never heard.
Did he ever get married and have children?
Doesn't say that either.
Huh.
You know, but you know, his business was boxing, and he made millions and millions at it.
Go back to Bat Masterson, because what's the history on him? Where did he come from, and how did he get his money?
Sounds like we got a...
Yeah, we got a call. Call it real fast. I've only got about 2 minutes left. Go ahead. Caller, good morning.
Nevada.
Pardon me?
There is a Goldfield, Nevada.
There is a Goldfield, Nevada. Where is it?
It's about 3 hours northwest of Vegas.
3 hours
northwest.
What do you do? Go up through Pahrump?
I'm not sure. I just Googled it on Google Maps and found that there was a Goldfield. It's over by a place that there's an international car forest, too, over there.
All right. Hey, listen, thank you very much for calling in on that. I'm deeply appreciative. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. So there is a Goldfield in Nevada.
Yeah. So that's the story of boxing in the Old West that moved into the into the early 20s.
But what about Bat Masterson? I mean, he made his history and his fame as being kind of a quasi-gunfighter and a sheriff, etc. Where did he come up with all the money and fame and everything?
I think they used him as a...
kind of a front man?
Yeah, just to, you know, here's a name that is famous. And you get some names like Masterson and Wyatt.
Okay, let's see what this caller's got to say. Caller, good morning. You're on the air. Quickly.
Cowboy Mike, how you doing?
Good, Mike. What do you know for us?
Goldfield, Nevada was discovered by... Hang on, let me turn the radio down. Was discovered by Diamond Field Jack, who was tried to be hung in Albion, Idaho, in the jails in Oakley. Just before they hung him in Albion, the governor put a stay of execution. A man got off the horse, got off the train, rode his horse across Snake River to Albion. When he got to Albion, the horse fell over dead.
No, be done.
They stopped the hanging of Diamond Field Jack.
Well, I appreciate the information. I'm almost...
Diamond Field, Nevada is very famous.
Okay.
That gold came out in ledges at first.
All right.
Diamond Field Jack was the first one to discover that gold there.
Thank All right. God bless you, man. Thanks. Appreciate it. Dr. History, final thoughts.
We've got a big story about Diamond Field Jack, and he did discover mines worth millions and millions, but died a pauper.
We'll take one more quick call. It's got to be fast. Go ahead, caller, fast. Caller, are you there?
Guess we lost.
As evidently, they're not there. Dr. History, you did a great job. I'd like to do some follow-up, though, on Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, and also tied into the fray is Doc Holliday.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Doc Holliday, the dentist.
There. Yep.
Yep. I do know quite a bit of history about Doc Holliday because of people that I know. I believe his home state was Georgia, where he was born and raised, and I know some of his ancestors.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to have their stories.
But anyway, he was a dentist that went sour.
He did. You could say that.
Yeah. Hey, thanks. Good job.
You bet.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, Zim.
God bless you. Stay warm.
I will.
Sure you don't want to take my tractor for me?
No, I'll let you do that.
All right.